Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Will you hear Jake say?
I will say something.
Jake is going to say something. That's good. And Jeff will say at some point, interesting. Which is what Mr. Spock said a lot.
He also said fascinating. He said fascinating and interesting, and you say both of those. Your eyebrows also have a nice arch to them when you say it. So I can't see your ears at the moment. They're covered in a headset. But it could be that there's a Vulcan in the studio.
Fascinating that you should say something like that, Captain Kirk. Anyway, you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach, and if you'd like to give us a call and discuss something to do with economics, investments, or that ilk, the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, and if you're a regular listener and you haven't got that etched in your brain someplace, then you're not a regular listener.
Right.
Anyway.
I wanted to correct myself. It was not Gonzalez that was the first vice president of Texas. It was Zavala. Lorenzo de Zavala.
Let me say that the big news in the employment release from the Bureau of Economic Analysis was not the fact that the unemployment rate is 4.9%, because it's been bobbing back and forth for a year now between 5 and 4.9 and then back to 5. The unemployment rate, there's two pieces of important news here. Not the unemployment rate, which has been fairly constant and very well may be what we call the natural unemployment rate. In other words, I don't think it's going to get a lot better than this. If it does, it would be a little scary, because the only times it's gotten a lot better than this was just before, it was in the late 1990s and again in 2006 and 2007. So during time periods when the economy is in overdrive and people are being incompetent, people or unskilled people, or basically people, we can't hire people. Once we get to the point where we're starting to hire people who really we shouldn't have hired, the economy is overheated and due for a fall. But that's not the big news. The big news is that wages year over year, after accounting for inflation, are up about 3.1%. And that is what?
I would say average hourly earnings have risen 2.8%, and the consumer price index is up 1.5%.
Right.
So they have more money than inflation is taking away.
But what I'm talking about is, if we look into some other data from other sources here, because these are hourly wages. If you throw in the salaried workers, it goes up 3.1%. And what that amounts to is, if you take the number of people across the country who are working, and you look at the amount of money they're making, and you add 3.1% to that in a year.
You're talking about the productivity right. number, I think.
Okay, well, maybe it's 2.8.
2.8, yeah.
No, that's hourly workers. Nice. That's hourly workers, though.
It's average hourly salary and hourly workers. They're all considered in the same average.
Anyway, we've got a significant rise in productivity. We've got a significant rise in wages at the same time. So what we have is more good by people who have seen a raise in their wages, and you add that in to the growth rate. And again, roughly 67 to 70% of the gross domestic product of the United States is us making things to sell to people who use them. Those are called consumers. They don't resell them. And that's a very healthy thing to be positioned to be in, despite the fact a lot of people would like us to do more exports. When you're doing an export, your customer is someplace else, and their economic troubles can be troubles for you. But here's the issue. We have more workers making more money, making more things, but the stock market has been flat for 2 years.
Right.
There's a reason for that, and it is the high savings rate.
There.
But the high savings rate and the huge amount of cash sitting on the sideline are the recipes not for an economic downturn, not for a recession. We don't see that behavior pattern before economic downturns or recessions. What we see is people spending too much. We see people without savings. we see people that are living beyond their means, and what we're seeing now is people who are living well below their means. And once, if we ever get through this election cycle, which we may not for 8 years.
Right. It may be a perpetual election cycle forever.
But the point is that once people get the impression that everything's going to be okay.
And that could be an either candidate.
Then they're going to probably start spending again. And once they start, and the other thing is, like you mentioned housing. Across the board, we're getting anecdotal reports that people who want to build houses can't build the houses. They have people who want to buy. They have people who have their 20% down payment, and they want to build a house for them. And the bank says, no, 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 no. Back in 1846, their grandfather missed a payment on a loan because he was sick.
Right. And the shoe size was not the right one for our figures here. Yeah.
And at some point, that's going to relent.
And in completely non-anecdotally, where we can look at it and see actual numbers, household formations are not keeping up with new people being born and coming onto the scene. That means the demand is increasing, and we've got enough money to buy the house, but there's not enough houses on the market. There's not enough houses being built.
I really think there's a very high probability that in December the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates.
I do too. I would put it at 80% probability.
And I think your mortgage rates will inch up a little bit, and something that is actually typical in history but defies our paradigm of the way things ought to work.
People are going to jump in and try to get a lot of mortgages right as the interest rates start going up.
As interest rates start to rise back to normal, they're below where they should be by any economic standard today.
Way below.
Banks can't make money on mortgages, so they're really hesitant. It's not just the regulators. They're blaming the regulators. It's not just the regulators. The banks flat don't want to make a mortgage because there's not any profit in it.
Right. If you think about a 3.5% mortgage, they've got to pay income taxes on that, and if inflation runs at 2%, which is pretty close to the target the Fed wants, that means with taxes, they make $0 for 30 years.
So here's the point. Once interest rates start up, I think, and by the way, this has happened all through history when we've hit an interest rate bottom like this after 30 years of falling interest rates. Once interest rates start back up towards normal, I think it's going to trigger a big move in banks willing to lend, people willing to build, people willing to buy. We are going to see what typically happens in the early stages of a rising interest rate environment, and that's called an economic boom. And I really think the next, I don't know, between now and 2015, no, it is, it's 2016.
Boy, we're going backwards in
but
time.
Between now and 2030, next 14 years or thereabouts, we're likely to see one of the greatest economic booms in the history of the United States. And that one of the reasons I say that is no one else is saying it.
Right.
When no one is expecting an economic boom, they save a lot of money and they don't invest, and that's what's happened over the last year. The reason the stock market's been flat is really simple. Nobody's investing money. I mean, the people who have their money in there are not yanking it out, but the people who have extra money to invest aren't investing it. And the people who sell something that they would just normally sell because it's time to sell that thing are just leaving it in cash. And by the way, the higher Trump's polls go, the further the market is going to slide down because people see Trump as an uncertain factor.
Right. And that doesn't mean that he's not going to do well, but it's very common for the investors in an unknown situation to be uncertain. That's what happens when the market's uncertain, it goes flat or down. And yesterday, this is a great example of uncertainty. It's not just Trump. It's uncertainty, period. Yesterday, one of the big headlines on the Drudge Report, which a lot of people go to, was 94.6 million people no longer in the labor force. That's the highest it's ever been. And that was the headline, that that many people not in the labor force anymore. And the word anymore shouldn't be involved here, but this is important to know. It's actually very, very good news. Let me tell you some numbers that will explain that. We're talking about 1 or 2 million different from the normal not in the labor force percentage rate. So 1 or 2 million people not being in the labor force. Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics again comes out with the question of how many people are in the labor force and how many people do not want a job now in that labor force. So these are people that do not want a job. They're either a homemaker and don't want a job, or they're retired, or any number of other things that say, we don't need a job anymore, thank you. In the age group 55 years and over, which is the oldest age group that they measure, if you're above 55, this is an old statistic that's just being updated regularly, they think that you're old, even though we live a lot longer these days, so 55 is not very old.
Basically, they're talking about the baby boomers and the few remaining people from the previous generations.
Right. A year ago, October of 2015, there were 51 million. So think of that 92 million that I, or 96 million that I just said. 51 million people above the age of 55 that say they don't want a job right now. They're still considered someone that was part of the workforce. So 51 million retirees. Okay, that's a big no-brainer, because we can start comparing that to the Social Security rolls and start saying, all right, this is starting to jibe. This year, there are less people that want jobs in that age group. Ah, imagine that. More people are retiring. This is the baby boomers. By about 1.3 million people. There are 52.3 million people in that age group that don't want a job anymore.
I can give you an anecdotal example of that.
You could probably give a lot of anecdotal examples
of that.
Very
specifically, I'm still working. I'm still employed. I'm still considered to be employed. My wife has retired.
Yeah.
And we see a lot of that. And one of
it's amazing what happens at retirement age.
What happens is we reach the point where we're getting older, but we're not really old. We don't think of ourselves as old. And we've had the typical two-income family for an extended period of time. And we realize, hey, we're in the home stretch. We're doing okay. It's not at all unusual for one of the two to retire before the other one does. And when that happens, we say, oh, this must be a discouraged worker who can't find a job. No, this is a person who could find a job anywhere, anytime, no problem. But they've reached a point financially where they don't need to find a job.
Right. And this last number, two numbers here, again, people above the age of 55, last year at this time, 1.6 million of them were looking for jobs. This time this year, 1.6 million of them are looking for jobs. They're probably a different 1.6 million. There's a very small, very tiny minority that are part of the same group that have been looking for a year. But what that says is that we're not experiencing unemployment here when people are leaving the workforce. We're experiencing the American dream. They are financially independent, and they don't have to work. So the number of people that say they do not want a job in that age category is growing faster than the rate of people leaving the workforce, which means more people are entering the workforce than leaving it, and it was a negative headline. It's a complicated set of numbers, but this is why we teach our kids math, because if you really want to look at the world, you don't say, I'm healthy now, I can drink this 2-liter jug of Mountain Dew, because you may be healthy now, but that doesn't mean you'll stay healthy if you keep doing that. When we're talking about math, it's not 1 plus 1, but what happens afterwards? If you plant an apple seed, it's not one apple seed that you're going to get out of that. You're going to get, hopefully the tree survives, and you're going to get a lot out of it. That's real math. That's economics. People think it's complicated. It isn't. It's real. And they know it in their own life. My dad, the old Baldy sitting here, has for many years talked about 1 plus 1 equals 7 and growing, because he and my mother got married and had 5 kids. And now a lot of his kids have had kids. And that says that...
Yeah, but it becomes a quadratic equation.
Right. And it gets complicated. But that's the way economics really has to be. That's why people say it's too complicated. Well, it's not. If you really want to understand what's going on, look around and say, all right, we've got more people leaving the workforce. And we've got a lot of people retiring. All you have to do is look at the Social Security rolls. It's really easy. How many people are taking Social Security? Well, they're probably less likely to want to work when the government's paying them money.
Well, I want to change the subject here to something and
go ahead.
Get us off the employment numbers, which I think are very impressive and very suggestive of two things. One, we're going to get an increase by the Fed, and B, we're going to get one and B. Boy, that's good, Jeff. You're doing really well. Number two.
One B, three.
Number two, we're probably going to have a major economic boom over the next several years. Okay, here's something else that defies paradigms. Across the board, there are massive flows of money in the mutual fund world.
Which board is this? I want to get involved in this board.
It's
this
a monopoly
money,
board.
Money flowing.
Right. There are huge flows of money out of active managed funds and into index funds. And that is because there's a lot of noise in the media about index funds are inherently better than actively managed funds. Well, Barron's has a really fascinating article today in its one of its main lead articles. 62% of value funds tracked by Morningstar are beating the index. It also, the headline is, active stock pickers are outpacing passive funds. That's a mouthful.
Wow, that sounded like a Tang Tungler.
But this is the point. 60% of actively managed funds this year are beating the Standard & Poor's 500 index. 60%. Now, that's an anomaly. Typically, we've seen around 50% over long-term periods of time. And I know that that...
Last year, it was the other way around,
right,
which is why we see this, that the index beat most active managers mm-hmm. last year, which is also a major anomaly. It's usually the average active fund beats their index.
Here is the point that comes up. If we have a long growth period, there's a whole series of situations that can create passive investing beating active investing. And in some instances, in very, very efficient markets, that's going to happen simply because the passive funds have less expenses than the active funds. But in the less efficient areas of the market, value is a less efficient area. That's why we like to invest in value positions, because by definition, they're undervalued.
By the way, just as a side note, value means that a company is valued on what it owns minus what it owes. It's pretty close to the market valuation on the stock market. And a growth would be a company that has very little assets but is being valued on its growth model.
They can have a lot of assets, but the issue is the pricing.
As a percentage
right,
the
pricing is based on the fact that we expect their earnings to grow. And the market expects earnings to grow. And the only reason I bring that up, not because I think it's unusual, but because the paradigm is that active investing never beats passive index investing. It's not true. Now, I will say it's a lot more work to find the active investors you probably ought to use than it is just to pick an index fund. But that's just a little tidbit that came out. I'm not making the claim. It's on the front page of Barron's, and it's news. But it's news that tells us that the mass of money that is flowing out of and has flown this year out of actively managed funds. Now, some of these funds, by the way, that are beating the S&P 500 have had massive outflows this year of money. Now, when you've got massive outflows, it's really hard to beat the index because you've got the massive outflows with people selling. So with that drag on there, they're still beating the index. And this is one of the prime things. Wherever the mass of people is going is generally the wrong place to go.
Go the other way. John Templeton, most people don't remember who that is anymore. Sir John Templeton
was one
of the greatest investors of the 20th century, and he has some of my favorite quotes in the world. But he said on multiple times that he believed in being a conscientious investor. When the rest of the world wanted to sell, he obliged them and bought. And when the rest of the world wanted to buy, he obliged them and sold. And when the rest of the world is doing something in the market, you don't want to be doing what they're doing, because that's kind of the definition of following the herd. If you follow the herd in the market, you lose. If you follow the herd when you're in a big crowded building and everybody starts running for the exits, it's probably a good idea to run for the exit. Or find your own exit, because it's a survival trait. It generally means that they know something you don't. When the herd is leaving the market, it's generally they're just scared and they're looking around. That's a good opportunity to step in and relieve them of some of their assets in a very kind and conscientious way. Say, I will pay you money at a much lower value than it was worth just a few moments ago because you wish to leave.
So, what else are we going to talk about?
Oh, we got lots.
Eurozone inflation reaches 2 years high.
Can we talk about something that's a little bit more apparent to the American public?
Okay.
You mentioned it, Epstein. The caller last hour at the end of the hour mentioned it, that he's a lot better off now than he was as a kid.
Not Epstein. Warren Buffett.
Warren Buffett. Okay. Ben Bernanke wrote an article, and he's at the Brookings Institute, by the way. That's what he's doing for a living these days. He's a distinguished fellow, which sounds like something from Mary Poppins, or I don't know. Hello, I'm a distinguished fellow. But that's his title at the Brookings Institute. And there's a new measure that talks about income. It talks about how we're doing. So what you were talking about, the hourly versus salary and the confusion there, we've got a number that represents the average of both of those, and it's not very accurate. And say, okay, we got a 2.8% growth in salaries hourly. What does that even mean? We're talking about an 8 cents per hour raise over a one-year period. That's nothing. What in the world are we measuring here? I mean, nobody. If you got an 8 cents an hour raise at your work, you'd be like, yeah, why didn't you just give me nothing? Sure, it makes me feel better. But what am I going to buy with 8 cents an hour? You can't even buy a coffee for a whole day's work on that. So there's a different measurement that's used, and it's just come out. Jones and Klenow is their people that have brought it out. But it has to do with economic welfare in comparison to income per capita. And I realize those are both big words, two big sets of words. Basically what it means is, how do you feel compared to how do other people feel? What is your standard of living? How much money do you make? What's your health like? All that stuff is being put together. Rather than saying a median or average income per hour, because you've got to take all these hours together and mix in all the... What this is saying is that the United States is the standard for the world still. In fact, the index is based on your average American. The index for an American is set at 100. Income per capita, if you look at everybody in the United States and you say the income that we make here, the income per capita, we'll call it 100. Great Britain is the second on the list, and they've got 75. But they've got a lot of entitlements that come on top of that. So what's their overall satisfaction? And their overall satisfaction, when we go over and say economic welfare, is 96, which means the second most happy nation in the world with where they are economically is 4% behind us. We're leading the world and getting better. And that's something that neither candidate in the political world is going to be talking about. We've been hitting a lot of the good things in the economy. There are bad things, too. And I wanted to hit that. I mean, if you want to hit the inflation in Europe right now, I think this is a good time. We can talk about that. But health insurance is something that's popping up a lot, and I want to touch on that as well. So, and I'm sorry I interrupted you in the middle of your European thing. I thought this was a good tie-in to what were saying.
Well, it is, but the point I wanted to make there, we used to be terrified of inflation, and some people still are.
Right.
Because we remember when inflation was double digits and where our paradigm is shaped there. And the threat over the last decade has been deflation. Europeans have not been able to get out of deflation. And as several major commentators who have lots of credentials have said again and again, I haven't looked at the numbers myself, something like two-thirds of the government debt from developed countries in the world that's out there has negative interest rates on it. I found that to be astonishing as a number, but I would assume that Gundlach and some of the others who have made these comments have done their homework, and they're, because no one's contradicting them. We are coming out of a negative interest rate environment in real sense or in actual sense, and the fact that we're starting to get some inflation back into the system, we're starting to get wage increases back into the system, is just incredibly healthy. I'm really big positive on that. We are seeing a return to normal conditions, and I suspect within the next year or two, we will see the Federal Reserve pushing interest rates back up to what are considered to be normal interest rates. And I shouldn't say pushing. That's not the right term. Actually, what they're going to do is gradually stop holding interest rates down. And as that happens, no matter who gets elected president, we're going back to something that's a lot more normal, a lot better oriented on growth. One of the big things that's wrong with our economy right now is banks can't make money.
Right. And they're making money in ways like Wells Fargo, where they're trying to cut corners, and they're saying, how can we charge people for credit cards? How can we charge people for starting new accounts and for all the little bits of fees here? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the airlines. Your luggage now costs an additional 9 cents.
Well, one of the interesting things that's going on, you may remember that the centerpiece of the financial deal, the gigantic person in the room or entity in the room was Goldman Sachs and has been for a long time.
Right.
Goldman Sachs is trading right at book value. In other words, the price of the stock and the price of its actual assets, whether they break it up and sell it, are about the same. This is for a company that is the largest financial institution in the world, outside of maybe the United States government. I mean, it's just huge, and it is pervasive, and it sets the standard all across the world. That is an unhealthy condition, and what it boils down to, if Goldman Sachs can't make any money, it's going to be hard for you to get a mortgage.
If any of the major financial companies are having trouble making money on mortgages, then they're not going to be offering them. It's incentive. I mean, that's why mortgages have been slow. One, they're afraid of being burned. Two, the environment is such that they can't make money. So why should they take the risk that you're not going to pay at some point in the next 30 years for something that is not profitable?
To change subjects again, to move off to something else, I want to talk about a single word, and it's called fiduciary. I'm surprised to find that our clients even in some cases don't know the meaning of that word. But it's really, really, really important to you as an individual investor or anyone who trusts anybody on a financial basis. Your relationship with any kind of financial advisor or investment advisor is either adversarial or fiduciary. If it's adversarial, they're in the position where they say, we're in this to make money, and we're not going to disclose to you how we make money and whether you are getting the better end of the deal or not. That's not the deal. It's kind of like if I go into a store and I go to buy something, no matter how nice the person is in the store, they're not about to tell me what they paid for that item and how much profit they're going to make on it. They just don't do that. That's the way business works. If somebody is selling you something, they want to make money. Whether you make money or not in the deal is beside the point. In many cases, you're not trying to make money. You're just trying to get some utility. If I see something at the store and I can lay my hands on it and I say, that is worth, to me, more than the money I'm going to exchange for it, I buy it. But when you go into the financial world, you don't get to lay your hands on something and use it. I mean, if you buy, and I'm not suggesting you buy General Motors stock, if you buy General Motors stock, you don't get a car with it. I mean, if you bought a certain quantity of General Motors stock and as a result you got a car, you could look at the value of that car and what you paid for the stock and you could say, yeah, okay, I either got a good deal or I didn't get a good deal. But you don't. What you buy when you invest is a hope for a return in the future, and that return in the future in many cases is heavily negatively impacted by the fact that the broker dealer That's the people who actually sell it, and the representative are going to make a heck of a lot of money when you buy that thing. And there's a crucial, crucial, crucial term here. If somebody says, I will be in the financial advice business, says, I will be a fiduciary all the time under all circumstances for you, and they put it in writing, you probably can trust them. On the other hand, for example, if you go to a doctor, doctors are fiduciaries. They're required by law to act in your best interest. Lawyers are fiduciaries. They're required by law to act in your best interest. CPAs are fiduciaries. They're required by law to act in your best interest as long as they're practicing in their field. If you buy a piece of real estate from a physician, that doesn't mean he's acting in your best interest. It's an adversary relationship. And it's so important right now to understand that, because we're seeing more and more broker-dealers hit with fines. It was something, as the SEC pointed out, they have a record number of enforcement actions recently, and there's a reason for that. When the market's flat and margins are thin, the people who want to sell something like that have a tendency to push for the highest fees.
Right. When they can't make money in the traditional ways, you find new ways to do it. And the reason why they're new ways to do it is they may not have a whole lot of background. Mm-hmm. They may not know that this is the best way to do it. This is, on a much larger scale, what happened before the Great Recession, when new products were being offered with great commissions, but with no background into the efficacy. How well is this thing going to actually perform long term? We don't have the history of it.
Well, the FINRA just hit six different broker dealers with millions of dollars in fines because they were pushing the sale of certain products because they paid unusually high fees to the broker dealer. To those people, like Merrill Lynch is a broker. Merrill Lynch is a broker dealer. It's just a branch of Bank of America now. Edward Jones is a broker dealer, and so on. The point is that in many cases, and this is one of the things that came up after the investigation, the representatives didn't know that what they were selling was pretty toxic for the investor. They knew that the company that they worked for told them to sell it, and it was good. And they told them, the company said, we will pay you extra to sell this, and that's good. So go out and sell it because it's good for your customers. Well, it turned out it wasn't good for their customers, and a whole series of them got hit with major fines. That doesn't make the popular headlines, but it does make the industry headlines.
Right. And we've got some commercials to play. If you'd like to call us during the commercials or after, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Hey, we are getting back in the habit of being able to say our names clearly and with great elocution.
I wouldn't go that far.
Electrocution?
That may be better.
Okay. Well, you are listening.
It is shocking.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. And we'd love to hear from you if you have any comments about something to do with economics or anything of that ilk. We basically have been saying for the last hour and 45 minutes that the economy is in good shape. Right now, we've had the economy growing for the last 2 years, and the market, if you've been invested in something, well, let's put it like this. I won't say where you've been invested, but the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index is basically where it was 2 years ago. So is the unemployment rate. Now, why? Probably because a lot of people are scared and uncertain at this point. And while we've seen growth in every aspect of the economy. Normally, the markets reflect the economy. But as we approach this time, and we do this from time to time, in our history, when we have a transition in power, a survey I read in the Wall Street Journal today said that the majority of investors would like to see Hillary Clinton in the White House and the Republicans controlling the Senate.
You said that 2 years ago we were at the same unemployment rate.
We've been bobbing along, well, at least certainly for the last year.
Last year, yeah. But I mean, it was 5.7% 2 years ago.
Okay, so the last year we've been at the same.
Almost a full percentage point.
We've got, you're right, you're completely correct. The market's where it was 2 years ago, but the unemployment rate, well, that's another point. The market has, normally when you see unemployment drop by 1%, that's a big difference when you see the fact that the growth has been consistent. Now, in any given quarter, such as the oil downturn creating a negative quarter in the first quarter of the United States, actually, they revised that up to 0.8, but nobody notices the revisions except us. So we actually have had positive economic growth. We've had increases in employment, increases in productivity over that time period, increases in every metric we want to look at. And the market has remained pretty where it was.
Now, I said I was going to talk about this, so this is a good thing. There are some negatives out there. Before people think that we are completely coming out of left wing, the negatives have
right
been...
Right wing.
Or left or right wing. Oh, it doesn't matter.
You can be left and I'll
somewhere
be right.
In the wing. I don't consider myself either one of them. If we're coming out of center field, way out of center field, I think that's more where I represent. If we're coming out of center field, before you think we are not in the same ballpark as you are, there are some real issues in the economy. We're overregulated. The Affordable Care Act has hit the point where we predicted years ago when it was passed that we would have some really nice year-over-year for a few years, 4 or 5 years, of year-over-year lower increases in the rate of growth and sometimes negative. What does that mean? It means that for 2 years after it was passed, we had dropping in healthcare rates as far as insurance goes. We had very slow growth for multiple years after that. And now we're seeing rates go way up. And this is the point where we talked about it for years now. I read the Affordable Care Act when it was first passed. Yes, I'm one of those weirdos.
And there weren't as many pages in it as the newspaper said.
No, nowhere near as many pages. It was 700, not 7,000. I mean, the people, I don't know where they were getting their numbers. So maybe they were looking at all possible versions of it before it was passed. I don't know. But
now, they saw an internet ad that went by.
Right, exactly. And nobody read it. Well, I'm one of the nobodies that read it. So in reading it, there are some real problems with the law, and we're starting to run into it. The rate is going back up to what it was before the Affordable Care Act was passed. People don't realize that because we've had years in a row where it hasn't been so bad, so it's hitting right now. There are lots of stuff in there that needs to be fixed. Some people say repeal and replace, some people being one side. The other side saying there's nothing wrong with it. It's perfect.
Well, I think even they say it's going to take some fixing.
Well, both sides have a small minority that say it takes fixing. But right now in the political debate, it's either you're for it or against it. It's either from heaven or from hell. And the reality is that to repeal it would be to remove coverage for almost everyone, because the current coverage is based on that law. Something would have to be created to replace it, and it's not there. Now that's something important to recognize. Congress would have to pass a replacement before it could be repealed. Otherwise, everyone would lose their coverage. Everyone being slightly hyperbolic, but not crazy hyperbolic. There are a lot of people would lose their coverage. I would. You would. Most people would lose their health insurance coverage. There's some problems here. Let's get them fixed. Social Security. The fact is that we're living longer, and every year we live longer than the year before. That means Social Security has some issues. It's on the horizon. It's out there. We've got to deal with this stuff, and it's not even on the table right now. There are a lot of pieces of the economy that aren't part of our day-to-day existence that are having a negative impact on us. And one real quick example is the restaurant employment world is not doing as well as the rest of the country. If you're in the restaurant business, you know this, because there are requirements from the Affordable Care Act that make it very hard to stay profitable if you actually employ your waiters and waitresses. There are things that need to be fixed, and we've been talking about that particular example since it was passed. There are a lot of things out there that are problematic. They're just not impacting us in a very big way right now. And people will say, well, I'm impacted very much by the health insurance raise. The rate's going up. I'm very much impacted. Not compared to what you would have been had the Affordable Care Act not been kept. All you have to do is look at the numbers of the rate of growth before it. Now, it was kind of a cheat in that the first few years of the Affordable Care Act, they didn't bring in a lot of the people with a lot of illnesses. They brought in the most healthy group to bring down the price. Now we have to deal with what we have in front of us. And the reality on the ground is that if Donald Trump is elected, he's not going to have the votes to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It's just not going to be possible. If Hillary Clinton is elected, she's not going to have the votes to raise taxes. It's just not going to happen. That's the reality on the ground. A lot of people are busy, heatedly debating things that are not possible one way or another. And those are the big rallying cries for both sides. And I think it's kind of silly.
Well, this is why the Wall Street Journal and other places have reported that when they poll investors, the consensus is that they would like to see a Democrat in the White House and the Republicans control Congress, because nothing will get done.
Right. And I'm pretty happy
with
that.
And by the way, the markets would be thrilled if we had a divided government at each other's throats where nothing gets changed.
So the argument that I hear from both sides comes back to the Supreme Court. And I kind of think that, again, if we have a close Senate, close Democrat, close Republican, we're not going to get extremists on the court, period. They're not going to be approved. So again, the two-party system, checks and balances are working and will work. We're not going to have a complete replacement of the Supreme Court by either candidate, because we've got two candidates that are the most unpopular candidates since we've been measuring popularity.
And the other thing about Supreme Court, people are very upset about the potential to get a Supreme Court nominee who will do, or appointed, who will do something or won't do something. One of the great fascinations to me is if you actually follow who appointed them and what they were perceived at. Reagan appointees to the Supreme Court turned out to be
fairly liberal.
Fairly liberal. And there have been a whole series of supposedly liberal appointees to the Supreme Court who wound up being conservatives. Now, there's a few people like Clarence Thomas who aren't going to budge a minute. He's mad, and he's going to stay mad.
Right.
And I don't blame him.
Scalia was another example of that. They were very clearly very conservative and still are. So Scalia is no longer around, but he was very definitely not going to change from a very conservative viewpoint.
And Roberts was going to be a conservative and has wound up being a moderate.
Which is kind of what I expected at the time, because we had a Democratic Senate when he was nominated. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't have approved a conservative.
And I think that very frankly, no matter who wins the Senate, it's not going to be an overwhelming number, and the other side will be able to filibuster. And
that will stop nominations. If we want to get a Supreme Court justice in there, we're going to have to compromise, period.
Now, I will say, I think the idea of the Senate holding up somebody who was pretty clearly a moderate in the hope of getting a conservative appointed, or a conservative president who would nominate somebody who was conservative, since by every definition of every conservative I know, neither of the presidential candidates are conservatives.
Correct.
And I'm going to say that you may not agree with me on that. I don't know. But the point is, this is the interesting point, and we've said this before. The budget deficit isn't being discussed by either presidential candidate.
Because in my analysis, in the Brookings Institute's analysis, in the conservative think tank analysis and the liberal think tank analysis, both candidates will increase the deficit hugely over their presidency if what they promise actually happens.
And this is the great irony. You want this, every several decades, and in this case, it was in the 1960s and 70s, the parties reversed positions. And the reversal this time is so clear. Trump's Republican Party platform would create deficits that would make the ones that Clinton has proposed look minor.
Right. And I did an analysis on this a few, probably 2 months back, based on their economic plans, as mentioned. The first year of his presidency, if they both got somehow the magic wand to say, we get everything we ask for, the first year of his presidency, we would have a surplus. And every year after that would grow the deficit beyond the level that it ever was under Obama, which is definitely not conservative. If you take the deficit under Hillary Clinton, we're going to have raises in the deficit going forward incrementally instead of exponentially, but there, none of them are new. Nobody's conservative right now. So,
anyway, we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I've got one quick question. I hear you talking about the Supreme Court judges and everything, which concerns me considerably. But my biggest concern is all these Muslims that they're going to bring into this country if Hillary is elected. What is your feelings on that? And I'll just listen to what you got to say.
Okay. You got a point there. The mayor of London is a Muslim.
Yeah, I know that.
And you've got some very, very responsible people out there who are Muslims. Now, there are radical, for instance, the people who recently have been shooting police officers. I don't know if you kind of track who does that, who sets up the ambushes and shoots police officers. Those weren't Muslims.
Not Muslims.
No. So the point is, bringing Muslims into the country, we don't bring Muslims into the country, by the way. And if you brought 64,000 or 100,000 people in this country, it would be such a drop in the bucket you wouldn't even notice where they went. But we have brought, for instance, people in from Southeast Asia in the past who have become very, very productive members of our society. They're some of the most productive members of our society. But we didn't identify them by religion. And in fact, many of the people who came in the large influx of people out of Southeast Asia were Muslims. Now, we just haven't made a big deal out of it. But there's different branches of Islam. And the other thing is, and this is the most fundamental thing to me, it's very, very simple. The Constitution of the United States forbids discrimination by religion. The only, and unless we're willing to shut down the Constitution of the United States, and that's what holds us together.
Yes, sir, I know that, but here's my major concern. You're looking at Hillary bringing in 600% more immigrants into this country, whether they be Muslims or whatever.
That's good.
You're looking at about $65,000, $70,000 a head. You're talking about $70-80 billion.
Where did you get the $65,000, $70,000 a head?
Oh, by the time you set them up with their health care and all their giveaways and everything.
No.
Wait a minute.
It goes the other way. When immigrants come in, every study I have read, and I've read a lot of them, says over the 10 years following the arrival of an immigrant in the United States, they contribute more to the economy and pay more taxes than the average American does.
And let me address the real issue. And this is the real issue. There's a concept right now. If we look at the Middle East, if we look at Europe, we see a different religion coming in and creating instability. That's how we founded this country.
Yes, sir, I understand that.
The vast majority of Muslims are not terrorists. The vast majority of Christians are not terrorists. Terrorists are fanatics. We don't want fanatics in the country. That's what we should be focusing on. And I'm sorry that we have to cut you off, but we have a hard break. We've got less than a minute left.
Okay.
Thanks
for
the call.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
So if you would like to contact us off the air, and particularly about that subject, because this is one that I think looking at data will help, email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can get podcasts of this and hear what we said. Then measure the data yourself. Look at the immigration rate. Look at that good stuff. It's real. It's there. It's how we founded the country. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we've got voicemail during the weekends locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. Again, if you'd like to get our newsletter, the webpage is the place to go, tpwc.com. It's a great newsletter. Old Baldy over here writes the massive lion's share of it, and I put some commas in occasionally.
Hope Belton Killeen Fort Hood, proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.